It is only after behavioral, procedural wisdom has become represented in episodic memory and portrayed in drama and narrative that it becomes accessible to conscious verbal formulation and potential modification in abstraction. Procedural knowledge is not representational in its basic form. Knowing how information generated in the course of exploratory activity can nonetheless be transferred from individual to individual in the social community through means of imitation. Piaget points out, for example, that children first act upon objects and determine object properties in accordance with these actions, and then almost immediately imitate themselves, turning their own initial spontaneous actions into something to be represented and ritualized. The same process occurs in interpersonal interaction, where the other person's action rapidly becomes something to be imitated and ritualized, and then abstracted and codified further. A shared right, where each person's behavior is modified by that of the other, can therefore emerge in the absence of consciousness of the structure of the right. However, once the social ritual is established, its structure can rapidly become described and codified, presuming sufficient cognitive ability and level of maturation. This process can, in fact, be observed during the spontaneous construction and then codification of children's games. It is the organization of such games and their elaboration through repeated communication that constitutes the basis for the construction of culture itself. Behavior is imitated, then abstracted into play, formalized into drama and story, crystallized into myth, and codified into religion, and only then criticized in philosophy and provided post hoc with rational underpinnings. Explicit philosophical statements regarding the grounds for and nature of ethical behavior, stated in a verbally comprehensible manner, were not established through rational endeavor. Their framing as such is clearly a secondary endeavor, as Nietzsche recognized. What the scholars called a rational foundation for morality and tried to supply was, seen in the right light, merely a scholarly expression of the common faith in the prevalent morality, a new means of expression for this faith. Explicit moral philosophy arises from the mythos of culture, grounded in procedure, rendered progressively more abstract and episodic through ritual action and observation of that action. The process of increasing abstraction has allowed the knowing what system to generate a representation in imagination of the implicit predicates of behavior governed by the knowing how system. Generation of such information was necessary to simultaneously ensure accurate prediction of the behavior of others and of the self, and to program predictable social behavior through exchange of abstracted moral, procedural information. Nietzsche states further that individual philosophical concepts are not anything capricious or autonomously evolving, but grow up in connection and relationship with each other. That however suddenly and arbitrarily they seem to appear in the history of thought, they nevertheless belong just as much to a system as all the members of the fauna of a continent, is betrayed in the end also by the fact that the most diverse philosophers keep filling in a definite, fundamental scheme of possible philosophies. Under an invisible spell, they always revolve once more in the same orbit, however independent of each other they may feel themselves with their critical or systematic wills. Something within them leads them, something impels them in a definite order, one after the other, to wit, the innate systematic structure and relationship of their concepts. Their thinking is, in fact, far less a discovery than a recognition, a remembering, a return and a homecoming to a remote, primordial, and inclusive household of the soul, out of which those concepts grew originally. Philosophizing is, to this extent, a kind of atavism of the highest order. The knowing what system, declarative, episodic, and semantic, has developed a description of knowing how activity, procedure, through a complex, lengthy process of abstraction. Action and imitation of action developmentally predate explicit description or discovery of the rules governing action. Adaptation, through play and drama, preceded development of linguistic thought and provided the ground from which it emerged. Each developmental stage, action, imitation, play, ritual, drama, narrative, myth, religion, philosophy, rationality, offers an increasingly abstracted, generalized, and detailed representation of the behavioral wisdom embedded in and established during the previous stage. The introduction of semantic representation to the human realm of behavior allowed for continuance and ever-increasing extension of the cognitive process originating in action, imitation, play, and drama. Language turned drama into mythic narrative, narrative into formal religion, and religion into critical philosophy, providing for exponential expansion of adaptive ability. Consider Nietzsche's words once again. Gradually it has become clear to me what every great philosophy so far has been, namely, the personal confession of its author and a kind of involuntary and unconscious memoir. Also, that the moral or immoral intentions in every philosophy constituted the real germ of life from which the whole plant had grown. The procedural system provides, constitutes, memory for behavior. Such memory includes imitative representation of behaviors generated spontaneously in the course of creative individual action, whose precise circumstance of origins have been lost in the mists of history, but which have been integrated into a consistent behavioral pattern over time, integrated into culturally determined character. Integration means active balance of competing subjectively grounded motivational demands within the context of the social environment, means internalization of socially regulated behavioral expression of subjective desire. Such internalization constitutes construction of a value dominance hierarchy, means determination of the relative contextual propriety, morality, of imitated or otherwise incorporated patterns of action. Such construction inevitably precedes episodic or semantic representation of the basis of the construction, although such second-order representation, once established, becomes capable, indirectly, of modifying procedure itself, as what is imagined can then be acted out. This is the loop that feeds the development of explicit consciousness itself. Procedure is established, then represented, then altered in abstraction, then practiced. The procedure changes as a consequence of the abstracted and practiced modification. This change in turn produces an alteration in its representation, and so on, from individual to individual, down the chain of generations. This process can occur externally as a consequence of social interaction, or internally as a consequence of word and image-mediated abstract exploratory activity, thought. This interactive loop and its putative relationship to underlying cognitive memory structures are represented schematically in Figure 13, Abstraction of Wisdom and the Relationship of Such Abstraction to Memory. Only a few of the interactions between the stages of knowledge are indicated for the sake of schematic simplicity. Behavioral knowledge is generated during the process of creative exploration. The consequences of such exploration, the adaptive behavioral patterns generated, are imitated and represented more abstractly. Play allows for the generalization of imitated knowledge and for the integration of behaviors garnered from different sources. One good thing to do may conflict in a given situation with another. Good things to do, therefore, have to be ranked in terms of their context-dependent value, importance, or dominance. Each succeeding stage of abstraction modifies all others, as our ability to speak, for example, has expanded our capacity to play. As the process of abstraction continues, and information vital for survival is represented more simply and efficiently, what is represented transforms from the particulars of any given adaptive actions to the most general and broadly appropriate pattern of adaptation, that of creative exploration itself. This is to say, individual acts of voluntary and successful encounter with the unknown might be broadly imitated, might elicit spontaneous imitation, but some more essential, prototypical features characterize all such acts. With increasing abstraction and breadth of representation, essential features come to dominate particular features. As Mircea Eliade points out, traditional, that is, non-literate, cultures have a historical memory that may be only a few generations long. That is, as long as the oldest surviving individual is old. Events that occurred previous to this are telescoped into something akin to the Aboriginal Australian's dream time, the trans-historical period when ancestral giants walked the earth and established the behavioral patterns comprising the present mode of being. This telescoping, the mythologization of history, is very useful from the perspective of efficient storage. We learn to imitate and to remember, not individual heroes, the objective historical figures of the past, but what those heroes represented, the pattern of action that made them heroes. That pattern is the act of voluntary and successful encounter with the unknown, the generation of wisdom through exploration. I am not trying to imply, either, that the semantic or episodic memory systems can directly modify procedure. It is more that the operations of the semantic episodic systems alter the world, and world alterations alter procedure. The effect of language and image on behavior is generally secondary, mediated through the environment, but is no less profound for that. The fact that the many stories we live by can be coded and transmitted at different levels of abstraction, ranging from the purely motoric or procedural, transmitted through imitation, to the more purely semantic, transmitted through the medium of explicit ethical philosophy, say, makes comprehension of their structure and interrelationships conceptually difficult. This difficulty is compounded by the fact that different stories have different spatial-temporal resolutions. That is, we may be governed at one moment by short-term simple considerations and at the next by longer-term, more complex considerations. Someone married might think, for example, I find my friend's spouse particularly attractive. I would like to make love to him or her, evaluating that individual positively. And then immediately correct. My friend's spouse flirts too much for his or her own good and looks like a lot of trouble. Perhaps both these viewpoints are valid. It is certainly not uncommon for the same stimulus to possess competing valences. Otherwise, as I have said before, we would never have to think. Every apprehensible phenomenon has a multitude of potential uses and significances. It is for this reason that it is possible for each of us to drown in possibility. Even something as simple as a piece of paper is not simple at all, except insofar as implicit contextual determinants make it appear so. The philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein asks, "Point to a piece of paper. And now point to its shape. Now to its color. Now to its number. That sounds queer. How did you do it? You will say that you meant a different thing each time you pointed. And if I ask how that is done, you will say you concentrated your attention on the color, the shape, etc. But I ask again, how is that done? A kitchen knife, for example. Is it something to cut up vegetables at dinner? Something to draw for a still life? A toy for Mumbledy Pig? A screwdriver to fix a shelf? An implement of murder? In the first four cases, it possesses a positive valence. In the last case, it is negative, unless you're experiencing a frenzy of rage. How is its essential functional and affective multiplicity reduced to something singular and, therefore, useful? You can't fix the shelf and make dinner at the same time and in the same place. You may need to do both at some point, however, and this means that you must maintain the multiple uses and valences as possibilities. This means that you must, 1, decide on one course of action and eliminate all the rest, yet, 2, retain the others for future consideration to ensure that your range of possible actions remain as broad as possible. How is this ever-present competition to be ameliorated? How might the process of amelioration be considered with regard to the additional complicating fact of the multi-level embodiment and abstraction of stories? So far, we have considered the ends and the means of a given framework of reference, a story, as qualitatively different phenomena, echoing a dilemma that pervades ethics as a field of study. The end or goal of a given planned sequence of behavior constitutes an image of the desired future, which serves as point of contrast for the unbearable present. The means by which this end might be attained comprises the actual behavioral steps that might be undertaken in pursuit of such desirable change. This seems a very reasonable perspective, in that at any given moment means and ends might be usefully distinguished. Where we are going is evidently different than how we will get there. This conceptual utility is only provisional, however, and the fact of the means-end distinction actually obscures more detailed and comprehensive description. Means and ends, plans and goals, are not qualitatively different in any final sense, and can be transformed one into the other at any moment. Such transformation occurs, in fact, whenever a problem arises, whenever the unknown manifests itself in the course of our ongoing behavior. It is in this manner that we switch spatial-temporal resolution, change set, or shift our frames of reference in order to reevaluate our actions and reconsider the propriety of our wishes. Our stories, our frames of reference, appear to have a nested or hierarchical structure. At any given moment, our attention occupies only one level of that structure. This capacity for restricted attention gives us the capability to make provisional but necessary judgments about the valence and utility of phenomena. However, we can also shift levels of abstraction. We can voluntarily focus our attention, when necessary, on stories that map out larger or smaller areas of space-time. Excuse the Einsteinian reference, but it is in fact accurate in this case, as our stories have a duration as well as an area. When necessary means depending on the status of our current operations. For example, say you are in the kitchen and you want to read a book in your study. An image of you reading a book in your favorite chair occupies the ends or desired future pole of your currently operational story, contrasted with the still too illiterate you of the present time. This story might have a conceived duration of, say, 10 minutes. In addition, it occupies a universe defined by the presence of a half dozen relevant objects: a reading lamp, a chair, the floor you have to walk on to get to your chair, the book itself, your reading glasses, and the limited space they occupy. You make it to your chair. Your book is at hand. You reach up to turn on the reading light. Flash! The bulb burns out. The unknown, the unexpected in this context, has just manifested itself. You switch set. Now your goal, still nested within the reading a book story, is fix the reading lamp. You adjust your plans, find a new bulb, and place it in the lamp. Flash. It burns out again. This time you smell burnt wire. This is worrisome. The book is now forgotten, irrelevant given the current state of affairs. Is there something wrong with the lamp? And therefore, at a slightly more general level, with all future plans that depend on that lamp? You explore. The lamp doesn't smell. It's the electrical outlet in the wall. The plate covering the outlet is hot. What does that mean? You shift your apprehension up several levels of spatial-temporal resolution. Maybe something is wrong with the wiring of the house itself. The lamp is now forgotten. Ensuring that your house does not burn down has suddenly taken priority. How does this shift in attention occur? Figure 14, conceptual transformation of the means-ends relationship from static to dynamic, presents a tripartite schematic designed to take us from the state where we conceptualize means and ends as distinct to the state where we see them as isomorphic elements given distinct status only on a provisional basis. Subdiagram 1 is familiar and represents the normal story composed of present state, desired future state, and three of the various means that might be utilized in order to transform the former into the latter. This subdiagram is predicated on the presumption that many means might be used to get from point A to point B. In truth, however, only one means, the most efficient or otherwise desirable, will be employed at any one time. We only have one motor output system, after all, and, therefore, one consciousness? Subdiagram 2 is a transformed version of 1, showing that the plans of 1 can be better conceptualized as stories in and of themselves, showing that a big story, one that occupies a large spatial-temporal domain, is actually composed of nested little stories. Subdiagram 2 is still predicated on the presumption that a number of smaller stories might be used as a means for a larger end. If your company is failing, you might fire half your employees, branch out into a new product line, or cut the salaries of your upper management. Each of these approaches, all designed for the same purpose, are clearly different and complex in their internal structure. You might do more than one thing, but if two of these multiple things conflict, one will have to be made subordinate to the other. Plans and ends are granted comparative importance and organized accordingly. This state of affairs, where the relative importance of potentially competing plans has been fixed, is represented in subdiagram 3, which will remain our representation of choice. At any given place and time, we are considering only a fixed number of variables as means and ends. This is absolutely necessary, as action requires exclusion as much or more as inclusion. However, those things we consider as relevant variables, and their status as relevant or not, have to be mutable. We have to decide, yet retain the capacity to alter our decisions. Our prefrontal cortex, critical to goal-directed action, appears to allow us this freedom. It does so by temporally sequencing events and actions, by considering contextual information and using that consideration to govern behavior, and by shifting set. It performs this multiplicity of operations, I submit, by considering one thing, then another, as the currently operative consummatory reward, as the goal toward which behavior is to be devoted, as the desired future against which the unbearable present in the form of emergent experience is to be compared and evaluated. The structure in Figure 14, subdiagram 3, is a multi-level, nested structure composed of the interdependent goals and plans comprising the life story. This conceptualization helps explain the idea of a step along the way, a stairway or ladder to heaven, metaphorically speaking. Each step, each substory, has the same structure, but not the same content, as all those stories above and below. This means that all the elements of a good story might be expected to mirror, in some profound manner, all the other elements. That a story, like the world itself, might be read, and read correctly, at multiple and multiply informative levels of analysis. This gives good stories their polysemous quality. It is for this reason that Northrop Frye can state, "One of the commonest experiences in reading is the sense of further discoveries to be made within the same structure of words. The feeling is approximately, there is more to be got out of this, or we may say, of something we particularly admire, that every time we read it, we get something new out of it." A phenomenon that constitutes a goal at one level might be regarded as an incentive reward at the next, since the attainment of subsidiary goals are preconditions for the attainment of higher-level goals. This implies that most consumatory rewards will simultaneously possess an incentive aspect. The cognitive operations dependent upon the intact prefrontal cortex can move up and down these levels, so to speak, fixating at one and allowing for determinate action when that is deemed most appropriate, making the others implicit at that place and time, reorganizing and reconstituting the levels and their respective statuses when that becomes necessary. Figure 15, Bounded Revolution, sheds light on this process and, simultaneously, on the conundrum of relative novelty. How can a thing be radically new, somewhat familiar, or completely familiar? The simple answer is, a given phenomenon, a thing or situation, can have its utility and or meaning transformed at one level of analysis, but not at another. This means that novelty can be bounded, that something can be new in one manner but remain familiar at another. This upper familiar level provides walls of security. These walls enclose a bounded territory within which necessary change can occur without fear of catastrophe. Here is an exemplary story. I am an undergraduate. I want to be a doctor. I'm not sure exactly why, but that question has never become relevant, which is to say, my desire is an implicit presumption, an axiom of my behavior. I did well in high school. I have good marks in university as a pre-med student. I take the MCAT. I fail. 20th percentile. Suddenly, and unexpectedly, I realize that I am not going to be a doctor. The walls come tumbling down. My emotions, which were held in check by the determinate valences my ongoing story gave to experiential phenomena, now reemerge viciously in chaos. I am a depressed and anxious wreck. As I recover, I reevaluate my life. I am disciplined and have good academic skills. I like university. I like working with people. Many of the predicates of the doctor's story are still intact and do not need modification. I must journey further up the hierarchy then, maybe for the first time. We do not question a story when it is working. If it produces the desired results, it is correct. Why did I want to be a doctor? For monetary security. Because it was expected of me, for reasons of tradition, my father was a doctor. For reasons of status, because I could appease the suffering of others and be a good person. So, hierarchical organization. This takes, or even is, thought. Number one, I want to help people. Number two, I need some monetary security. Number three, I would like to stay in the health profession. Number four, perhaps status is not as important as I thought and might therefore be sacrificed to appease the angry gods and restore order to the cosmos. I will become a medical technician or maybe even a nurse. I can still be a good person even if I'm not a doctor, and perhaps that is the most important thing of all. Reorganization completed. Utility of experiential phenomena, reestablished. Emotional integrity and stability, reattained. Good thing I didn't do anything rash. It is interesting and instructive to consider Eastern representations of reality, that is, of the cosmos, in light of this conceptualization. Reality is made up of nested interpretations that give determinate form to objects as implements and to the valence of those objects. Every interpretation, however, is subject to transformation at every level. This constant and necessary transformation, in conjunction with the fact of at least transient and necessary stability, makes up the world. Mircea Eliade describes the Indian version of the doctrine of the eternal return, the endlessly nested cyclical nature of the universe, conceived of as the totality of experience and not as objective reality. A complete cycle, a Mahayuga, comprises 12,000 years. It ends with a dissolution, a pralaya, which is repeated more drastically, Mahapralaya, the great dissolution, at the end of the thousandth cycle. For the paradigmatic schema, creation, destruction, creation, etc., is reproduced ad infinitum. The 12,000 years of a Mahayuga were regarded as divine years, each with a duration of 360 years, which gives a total of 4,320,000 years for a single cosmic cycle. 1,000 such Mahayugas make up a kalpa, form. 14 kalpas make up a manvantara, so named because each manvantara is supposed to be ruled by Manu, the mythical ancestor king. A kalpa is equivalent to a day in the life of Brahma, a second kalpa to a night. 100 of these years of Brahma, in other words, 311,000 milliards of human years, constitute the life of Brahma. But even this duration of the god's life does not exhaust time, for the gods are not eternal, and the cosmic creations and destructions succeed one another forever. Every novelty-inspired, exploration-driven learning experience has a revolutionary element. It is just that those reconstructions that involve stories with very limited sizes, that is, spatial-temporal areas, release only a proportionate amount of emotion. The normal-slash-revolutionary dichotomy is, therefore, not valid. It is always a matter of degree. Small-scale inconveniences require minor life story modifications. Large-scale catastrophes, by contrast, undermine everything. The biggest disasters occur when the largest stories that we play out are threatened with dissolution as a consequence of radical environmental transformation. Such transformation may occur in the natural course of things when an earthquake or similar act of God takes place, may be generated internally as a consequence of heretical action, or may emerge when the foreign devils, emissaries of chaos, threaten our explored territories, our nested stories, our cultural stability. In the latter case, we may well turn to war as an alternative deemed emotionally desirable. Our stories are nested. One thing leads to another, and hierarchically arranged. Pursuit A is superordinate to pursuit B. Love is more important than money. Within this nested hierarchy, our consciousness, our apperception, appears to have a natural level of resolution or categorization. This default resolution is reflected in the fact, as alluded to previously, of the basic object level. We see some things naturally, that is, in the psychologist Roger Brown's terminology, at a level that gives us maximal information with minimal cognitive effort. I don't know what drives the mechanism that determines the appropriate level of analysis. Elements of probability and predictability must play a role. It is, after all, increasingly useless to speculate over increasingly large spatial-temporal areas, as the number of variables that must be considered increases rapidly, even exponentially, and the probability of accurate prediction therefore, decreases. Perhaps the answer is something along the lines of, the simplest solution that does not generate additional evident problems wins, which I suppose is a variant of Occam's razor. So the simplest cognitive/exploratory maneuver that renders an unpredictable occurrence conditionally predictable or familiar is most likely to be adopted. This is another example of proof through utility. If a solution works, serves to further progress towards a given goal, then it is right. Perhaps it is the frontal cortex that determines what might be the most parsimonious possible context within which a given novel occurrence might be evaluated. So, the notion would be that a novel occurrence initiates an exploratory procedure, part of which is devoted to determining the level of analysis most appropriate for conducting an evaluation. This would involve the shifting of stories. Also, a given stimulus is obviously not evaluated at all possible levels of analysis simultaneously. This would constitute an impossible cognitive burden. It seems that the cortex must temporarily fixate at a chosen level and then act as if that is the only relevant level. Through this maneuver, the valence of something can appear similarly fixed. It is only this arbitrary restriction of data that makes understanding and action possible. Anyway, we are adapted as biological organisms to construe our environment as a domain with particular temporal and spatial borders, that is, as a place of a certain size with a fixed duration. Within that environment, conceived of as that certain size and duration, certain phenomena leap out at us and cry out to be named. Whenever those natural categories of interpretation and their associated schemas of action fail us, however, we have to look up and down the scale of spatial-temporal resolution. We do this by looking at the big picture when we have to, or by focusing on details that may have previously escaped us. Both the details and the big picture may be considered as dwindling or trailing off into, first, the unconscious, where they exist as potential objects of cognition, and then the unknown, where they exist as latent information or as undiscovered facts. The unconscious may then be considered as the mediator between the unknown, which surrounds us constantly, and the domain that is so familiar to us that its contents have been rendered explicit. This mediator, I would suggest, is those metaphoric imagistic processes dependent upon limbic-motivated right hemispheric activity that help us initially formulate our stories. Figure 16, nested stories, processes of generation, and multiple memory systems, helps explain the idea of this unconscious. The broadest span stories, which are determined by complex social interactions, are episodic, imagistic, or even procedural, manifested only in socially modified behavior, in nature. There is a very narrow window of expressible frames of reference, conscious stories. Just ask any young child or unsophisticated adult to describe the rationale for their behaviors. Every level of analysis, that is, every definable categorization system and schema for action, every determinate story, has been constructed interpersonally in the course of exploratory behavior and communication of the strategies and results thereof. Our natural levels of apprehension, the stories that most easily or by default occupy our attention, are relatively accessible to consciousness and amenable to explicit verbal semantic formulation and communication. The higher level stories, which cover a broader expanse of spatial-temporal territory, are increasingly complex and therefore cannot be as simply formulated. Myth steps in to fill the breach. Mythological representation. The constituent elements of experience. Myth represents the world as forum for action. The world as forum for action comprises three eternally extant constituent elements of experience and a fourth that precedes them: the unknown, The knower and the known make up the world as place of drama. The indeterminate pre-cosmogonic chaos preceding their emergence serves as the ultimate source of all things, including the three constituent elements of experience. The pre-cosmogonic chaos tends to take metaphorical form as the Ouroboros, the self-consuming serpent who represents the union of matter and spirit and the possibility of transformation. The Ouroboros serves as primal source of the mythological world parents, the Great Mother, nature, deity of the unknown, creative and destructive, the Great Father, culture, deity of the familiar, tyrannical and protective, and of their divine son, the knower, the generative word, the process of exploration. The ancient Mesopotamian creation myth, the Enuma Elish, provides a concrete example of the interplay of these personalities. This myth features four main characters or sets of characters: Tiamat, the feminine dragon of chaos, primordial goddess of creation. The Ouroboros and the Great Mother are conflated, as is frequently the case in this myth. Apsu, Tiamat's husband and consort. The elder gods, children of Tiamat and Apsu. And Marduk, sun deity and mythic hero. Tiamat symbolizes the great unknown, the matrix of the world. Apsu, the known, the pattern that makes regulated existence possible. The elder gods symbolize the common psychological attributes of humanity, the fragments or constituent elements of consciousness, and constitute a more thorough representation of the constituent elements of the patriarchal known. Marduk, greatest of the secondary deities, represents the process that eternally mediates between matrix and regulated existence. The original union of Tiamat and Apsu brings the elder gods into being. These gods carelessly kill Apsu, upon whom they unconsciously depend. Tiamat reappears with a vengeance and decides to destroy everything she has created. Her children send one volunteer after another out to overpower her. All fail. Finally, Marduk offers to do battle. He is elected as king, the greatest of gods, the determiner of destinies, and voluntarily confronts Tiamat. He cuts her apart and creates the cosmos from her pieces. The Mesopotamian emperor, who ritually embodies Marduk, acts out this battle during the festival of the new year, when the old world is renewed. The Enuma Elish expresses in image and narrative the idea that the psychological function giving order to chaos, one, creates the cosmos, and two, should occupy a superordinate position in the intrapsychic and social domains. The ideas contained in this myth are given more elaborated expression in later Egyptian works of metaphysical speculation, which more directly address the idea of the heroic renewal of culture. The three constituent elements of experience and the fourth who precedes them can be viewed at a higher level of resolution as seven universal characters who may take on any of a variety of culture-specific identities. Myth describes the interactions of these characters. The great dragon of chaos, the Ouroboros, the self-devouring serpent, might be conceptualized as pure, latent information before it is parsed into the world of the familiar, the unfamiliar, and the experiencing subject. The Ouroboros is the stuff of which categorical knowledge is composed before being that knowledge. It is the primary element of the world, which is decomposed into cosmos surrounding chaos and the exploratory process which separates the two. The bivalent Great Mother, second and third characters, is creation and destruction simultaneously, the source of all new things, the benevolent bearer and lover of the hero, the destructive forces of the unknown, the source of fear itself, constantly conspiring to destroy life. The bivalent divine son, fourth and fifth, is the sun god, the hero who journeys to the underworld to rescue his incapacitated ancestors, the messianic son of the Virgin Mother, savior of the world. And, simultaneously, his sworn adversary, arrogant and deceitful. The bivalent Great Father, sixth and seventh, is the wise king and the tyrant. Cultural protection from the terrible forces of nature, security for the weak, and wisdom for the foolish. Simultaneously, however, he is the force who devours his own offspring, who rules the kingdom with a cruel and unjust hand, and who actively suppresses any sign of dissent or difference. Terrible, chaotic forces lurk behind the facade of the normal world. These forces are kept at bay by maintenance of social order. The reign of order is insufficient, however, because order itself becomes overbearing and deadly if allowed unregulated or permanent expression. The actions of the hero constitute an antidote to the deadly forces of chaos and to the tyranny of order. The hero creates order from chaos and reconstructs that order when necessary. His actions simultaneously ensure that novelty remains tolerable and that security remains flexible. From Goethe's Faust, Mephistopheles. Congratulations before you part from me. You know the devil. That is plain to see. Here, take this key. Faust. That little thing? But why? Mephistopheles. First grasp it. It is nothing to decry. Faust. It glows. It shines. Increases in my hand. Mephistopheles. How great its worth you soon shall understand. The key will smell the right place from all others. Follow it down. It leads you to the mothers. Introduction. Reasonable and informed observers, at least since the time of Sir James George Frazer, have established the widespread spatial and temporal dispersion of cosmogonic stories, tales of heroism and deceit, rituals of initiation, and standard imagistic representations, such as the Virgin and Child. These stories, tales, rituals, and images often differ in detail and temporal ordering. Sometimes, however, they are simply the same. It is possible that this similarity might be the consequence of dissemination from a single source hundreds of centuries ago. This hypothesis, however, does not explain why standard stories are remembered once disseminated and transmitted down the generations with little structural alteration. It is reasonable to presume that over the long run, our species forgets most things that are useless. We do not forget our myths, however. Indeed, much of the activity broadly deemed cultural is in fact the effort to ensure that such myths are constantly represented and communicated. Carl Jung attempted to account for the apparent universality of world interpretation with the hypothesis of the collective unconscious. Jung believed that religious or mythological symbols sprung from a universal source whose final point of origin was biological and heritable. His collective unconscious was composed of complexes, which he defined as heritable propensities for behavior or for classification. The Jungian position, which is almost never understood properly, has attracted more than its share of derision. Jung was not privy to our knowledge of the mechanisms of inheritance, a limitation necessarily shared by all members of his generation. The idea of collective memories appears impossible, Lamarckian, from the modern perspective. Jung did not really believe that individual memories themselves could be transmitted, however, although his writings, which are very difficult, do not always make this clear. When he speaks formally of the collective unconscious, he is at pains to point out that it is the possibility of categorization that is inherited and not the contents of memory itself. However, he frequently writes as if the contents, as well, might be inherited. The general irritation over Jung's heritable memory hypothesis has blinded psychologists and others to the remarkable fact that narratives do appear patterned across diverse cultures. The fact that all cultures use what are clearly and rapidly identifiable as narratives, or at least as rites, which are clearly dramatic in nature, in itself strongly points to an underlying commonality of structure and purpose. It might still be objected. Attempts to attribute comprehensible patterning to such narratives cannot be demonstrated without a theory of interpretation, and that theory may be merely reading in patterns where none actually exist. The same objection can, of course, be applied, and applied validly, to literary interpretation, the study of history, dream analysis, and anthropology. Cultural phenomena cannot be understood except from a cultural perspective. This fundamental problem, among others, makes verification of theories in the domain of value difficult. Nonetheless, to live, it is necessary to act. Action presupposes belief and interpretation, implicit if not explicit. Belief has to be grounded in faith in the final analysis, as the criteria by which a moral theory might be evaluated have to be chosen as well. There is no reason, however, why such faith cannot be informed and critically assessed. It seems reasonable to presume that cross-cultural analysis of systems of belief and their comparison with the essentially literary productions of the humanities might constitute a means to attain such information. This was Jung's approach. The causal mechanism he constructed to account for what he found, that is, the collective unconscious, appears insufficiently elaborated from the modern empirical perspective, although the idea is much more complex and much less easily dismissible than generally conceded. This does not mean that we should dismiss Jung's methodology or deride his otherwise valuable insights. Great modern minds working in areas outside of psychology have also concluded that stories have universal structures. How can the fact of pattern stories, archetypal stories, if you will, be reconciled with the apparent impossibility of inherited memory content? We might turn our attention to the phenomenon of language and the processes of its storage and transmission to find an answer. The human linguistic ability appears to have a relatively specific biological basis. Other animals do not have language in their natural states and cannot be taught language at any sophisticated level. Human children, by contrast, even when severely intellectually impaired, pick up language easily and use it fluently, naturally, and creatively. Language use is an intrinsic characteristic of Homo sapiens, and the structure of language itself appears biologically grounded. Nonetheless, human languages differ. A native Japanese speaker cannot understand a native French speaker, although it might be evident to both that the other is using language. It is possible for two phenomena to be different at one level of analysis and similar at another. The question might be asked, upon what data bank, so to speak, does a child draw when he or she learns to talk, read, write? The child listens to those around her. She is not explicitly taught how to talk, although some explicit teaching takes place. Her biological propensity encounters a cultural reality, the existence of language in the culture. Her parents serve as primary intermediaries of culture. They embody language in their behavior and transmit it to her during their day-to-day activities. Nonetheless, they cannot be said to be the creators of language, although they may use it idiosyncratically, even creatively. It is the capability for human linguistic activity, whatever that is the creator. The cumulative consequences of this capability, expressed over centuries, have modified the behavior of all the individuals who compose a given linguistic culture. Identifiable individuals serve as the temporary agents of embodied memory for the entire culture at any given locale and time. Nonetheless, the loss of a given individual poses no threat to the knowledge of the culture. This is because language is remembered, that is, embodied, in the behavior of all those who speak. Children pick up language by interacting with adults who embody language. Thus, they learn to speak and learn to know they have language, and even to observe and study the fact that they have language. The same holds true of moral behavior and of the belief that underlies it. Adults embody the behavioral wisdom of their culture for their children. Children interact with adults who serve as cultural emissaries. Obviously, a given adult may be a better or worse representative, just as a parent may be more or less literate. However, a bad example can be as exemplary as a good example. Furthermore, children are rarely limited in their exposure to a single hero. If there are no other adults around, in fact, they are inevitably present by proxy in entertainment, in ritual, drama, literature, and myth. The behavioral patterns that make up our stories might therefore be regarded as stored in our social behavior. This implies that such patterns may be abstracted from that behavior at any time. The collective unconscious is, from this perspective, embodied behavioral wisdom in its most fundamental form, is the cumulative transmitted consequences of the fact of exploration and culture on action. Our capacity for abstraction allows us to derive the constituent elements of successful adaptation itself from observation of behavioral patterns that are constantly played out in the world as it actually exists. The behavioral patterns that constitute adult interaction, for example, are exceedingly sophisticated and are conditioned to the last gesture by centuries of cultural work. We can extract images of these patterns. Such images, just as sophisticated as the behaviors they represent, constitute the building blocks for our stories and for our self-understanding. The admirable adult, an identifiable individual, keeps her house tidy and neat, reconciles her warring brothers, and learns hard moral lessons when such learning is necessary. The archetypal hero makes order out of chaos, brings peace to the world, and restructures society when it has become rigid and anachronistic. The collective unconscious that constitutes the basis for shared religious mythology is, in fact, the behavior, the procedures that have been generated, transmitted, imitated, and modified by everyone who has ever lived, everywhere. Images of these behaviors and of the transcendent place where they occur, the universe of chaos and order, constitute metaphors, symbolic images. Metaphors mediate between our procedural wisdom and our explicit knowledge. They constitute the imagistic, declarative point of transition between the act and the word. We have spent hundreds of thousands of years watching ourselves act and telling stories about how we act. A good story has a universal quality, which means that it speaks a language we all understand. Any universally comprehensible language must have universal reference, and this means that a good story must speak to us about those aspects of experience that we all share. But what is it that every human being shares, regardless of place and time of birth? Is it reasonable to posit that anything might remain constant, for example, across the centuries that separate us from our Stone Age ancestors, across the ideological and religious barriers that divide the inhabitants of our modern nations? Our distant predecessors lived much closer to nature, and the problems that beset them seem far removed from our current daily struggles. The great difference between us and them seems analogous in distance, if not precisely in kind, to that obtaining between the varied cultural worlds of today, to the great gap that still separates the Hindu religious mystic, for example, from the Manhattan investment banker. It is not surprising that a world characterized by such different human lives remains rife with constant intergroup conflict. Nor is it surprising that we might seem to have outgrown our traditional wisdom. But are there fundamental presuppositions we might agree upon and share, despite our differences? Most objects of experience have some properties in common while varying with regard to others. Generally, the similarities and the differences are both significant. So it is with individuals and with cultures. We seem peculiarly aware of our differences, however, and not of our similarities. Even groups of people who share much in common, at least from the perspective of more distant outsiders, the Irish Catholics and Protestants spring to mind, appear sufficiently conscious of those factors that make them unique in their social affiliation. I think this is in part because we are not built to focus on the predictable and familiar. Our attention gravitates naturally toward those aspects of our environments, natural and social, that contain information. The similarities of the Serb and the Croat are hidden from each other, so to speak, by a wall of habituation, but the differences stand out profoundly. To ask the question, what is it that two or more discriminable beings or things or situations might share, is really to ask, at what levels of analysis might two or more things be considered the same, and at what levels different? It is the particulars of our individuality, our specific time and place, that differentiate us from one another. What unites us is the fact of those particulars, however, the fact that we each have a specific time and place, and the implications of that fact for the nature of our existence. Our lives are open to possibility, but remain eternally bounded by disease, death, and subjugation to social structure. As mutable, limited social beings, we are all engaged in a massive, cooperative, and competitive endeavor. We do not understand the rules that govern this endeavor in the final analysis. We cannot state explicitly why it is that we do what we do. Our democratic constitutions, for example, which contain the most fundamental axioms of the body of law that we imitate, that governs our behavior, are inextricably embedded in the conception of natural rights, which is to say, in a statement of faith, we hold these truths to be self-evident. We are all, in consequence, imitating a story that we don't understand. This story covers the broadest possible expanse of time and space, at least that expanse relevant to us, and is still implicitly contained in our behavior, although represented, in part, in episodic imagery and semantic description. This partially implicit containment constitutes our mythology and our ritual, and provides the upper-level, unconscious frames of reference within which our conditional and expressible individual stories retain their validity. It is impossible to properly appreciate the nature of the categories of the mythological imagination without some understanding of the process of categorization. The act of categorization enables us to treat the mysterious and complex world we inhabit as if it were simpler, as if it were, in fact, comprehensible. We perform this act of simplification by treating objects or situations that share some aspect of structure, function, or implication as if they were identical. People are very good at categorizing. So good, in fact, that the ability is taken for granted and appears simple. It is not so simple, however. Neither the rules that underlie categorization nor the act itself have proved easy to describe. Roger Brown, the eminent psycholinguist, states, "Until about 1973, psychological experiments on category formation conceived of human categories on the model of a proper set. Triangles are a proper set, which means that members of the triangle class are precisely definable in terms of a conjunction of attributes true of all members of the set and of no non-members. A triangle is a closed, three-sided figure. From the fact that a clear definition exists, it follows that membership in the set is not a matter of degree. One triangle is no more essentially triangular than any other. An entity either is or is not a triangle." In retrospect, it is amazing that psychology was for so long able to think of real-life categories as proper sets. We ought to have worried more over the extreme difficulty everyone has in defining anything natural. And natural, as used here, includes not only dogs and carrots, but also artifacts like chairs, cars, and pencils. I know you can tell one when you see one, but just try listing the attributes that are true of all dogs and of no cats or wolves or hyenas, or of all the carrots and no radishes or turnips, or of all chairs and no small tables, hassocks, benches, or slings. In the natural state, so to speak, human beings do not think like logicians or even like empiricists. It takes training to think like that. In the absence of such training, we still think, however, but more subjectively, like unreasonable, idiosyncratically emotional beings who inhabit bodies of particular size with particular and constrained properties. Our natural categories, which are the groupings we generate spontaneously, do not consist solely of the consensually apprehensible properties shared by the things and situations we encounter. Neither are natural categories tightly bounded. Their borders are fuzzy and they overlap. The construction of proper sets is possible, obviously, since they exist, and the ability to construct and use such sets has proved useful in a broad variety of manners. Nonetheless, the capability that underlies such construction appears relatively new, phylogenetically speaking, and seems dependent at least in part on the ability to think empirically and to regard things objectively. In the absence of such ability, which requires specialized training, or at least immersion in a culture like ours where such thinking has become commonplace, people naturally incline toward the development of what has been described recently as the cognitive model. Cognitive models are characterized by a number of distinctive properties, as paraphrased in part from the psycholinguist George Lakoff. Number one, they are embodied with regard to their content, which essentially means that they can be used without necessarily being defined, are implicit in action without necessarily being explicit in description. Two things classified within the same cognitive model are two things that evoke the same behavior and can therefore be regarded, at least from the perspective of action, as one thing. If you are utilizing a cognitive model and someone asks you to describe its content, what makes a dog, you might say, "I can't say, but I know when one is around." You know that a dog is, for example, something friendly, something to be petted, and something to play with, although such knowledge does not constitute everything that makes up what you regard as dog. Most of the concepts you use are, in fact, embodied at the most basic of levels, are habitual, procedural, motoric, behavioral. You can use them without thinking. Those that are not can only be applied slowly, with full conscious attention and with effort. Number two, they are characterized by basic level categorization and basic level primacy. These terms mean, respectively, that the phenomena most naturally apprehensible to the human mind, perceptible as a whole or gestalt, nameable, communicable, manipulable, memorable, serve as the material for initial categorization, and that those initial categories provide the basis for the development of more abstract concepts, even for the comparison point for determining what we consider abstract. Most naturally apprehensible means learned and named first, generally with short names, and conceptualized at the level of distinctive action in association with such characteristic behaviors as petting for the category cat and smelling for the category flower. Our basic level categories reflect our structure as much as the structure of the external world. We most accurately conceive of those things that most simply present themselves to us. The higher and lower levels of category that surround these naturally apprehensible basic level phenomena might be regarded, in contrast, as achievements of the imagination, to use Roger Brown's phrase. We perceive the cat, for example, and infer the species that contains the cat, or the subtype that makes it Siamese. Our basic level categories generally occupy the middle of our conceptual hierarchies. We generalize when we move up and specialize when we move down. Number 3. They may be used in metonymic or reference point reasoning. Metonymic reasoning is symbolic in the psychoanalytic or literary sense. Metonymic means interchangeable and more. The fact that objects in a cognitive model have metonymic properties means that any or all of those objects can stand for any or all of the others. This capacity makes sense since all of the objects in a given category are by definition regarded as equivalent in some non-trivial sense, most generally in terms of implication for action. The human capacity for metaphor, aesthetic appreciation, and allusion seems integrally related to the capacity for metonymic reasoning and the use of richly meaningful cognitive models. Number 4. They are characterized by membership and centrality gradients. Membership gradients implies degree of membership, which is to say that an ostrich, for example, is a bird, but perhaps not so much of a bird as a robin, because the robin has more properties that are central to the category bird. A thing can be a better or worse exemplar of its category. If it is worse, it can still be placed within that category. Number 5. They contain phenomena associated as a consequence of familial resemblance, a term used first in this context by Ludwig Wittgenstein. Things with familial resemblance all share similarities with a potentially hypothetical object. The prototypical Smith brother, to use a famous example, may have a dark mustache, beady eyes, balding pate, thick horn-rimmed glasses, dark beard, skinny neck, large ears, and weak chin. Perhaps there are 6 Smith brothers in total, none of whom has all the properties of the prototypical Smith. Morgan Smith has a weak chin, large ears, balding pate, and skinny neck, but no glasses, mustache, or beard. Terry, by contrast, has the glasses, mustache, and beard, but a full head of hair, small ears, and a normal neck. Nelson has a receding hairline, beady eyes, and a dark beard and mustache, and so on for Lance, Randy, and Lyle. None of the brothers precisely resembles another, but if you saw them in a group, you would say, "Those men are all related." Number 6. They give rise to the phenomenon of polysemy, a defining characteristic of myth. A polysemic story is written and can be read validly on many levels. The phenomenon of polysemy, discussed in some detail later in this book, arises when the relationship of objects within a particular cognitive model is analogous in some sense to the relationship that obtains between cognitive models. Great works of literature are always polysemic in this manner. The characters within the story stand in the same relationship to one another as things of more general significance stand to one another in the broader world. The struggle of Moses against the Egyptian pharaoh, for example, to take a story we will consider later, can also be read as an allegory of the struggle of the oppressed against the oppressor, or, even more generally, as the rebellion of the world-destroying, flooding savior against society. To say that two separable things belong to the same category is a tricky business. We presume, without thinking, that we group things as a consequence of something about them rather than as a consequence of something about us. What do all chairs share in common, then? Any given chair may lack some of the most common chair attributes, such as legs, backs, or armrests. Is a tree stump a chair? Yes, if you can sit on it. It isn't really something about an object considered as an independent thing that makes it a chair. It is, rather, something about its potential for interaction with us. The category chair contains objects that serve a function we value. Chairs may be efficiently sat upon, at least potentially. Our action in the face of an object constitutes an elementary but fundamental form of classification, constitutes, in fact, the most fundamental of all classifications, the classification from which all abstracted divisions are derived. The category of all things that make you want to run away when you look at them might be considered, for example, a very basic form of construct. Closely related to this category, although slightly higher in the hierarchy of abstraction, might be the category of all objects to be feared, or all objects that are dangerous when approached in one fashion, but beneficial when approached in another.